This meeting of the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs will now come to order. It is 10:25 a.m. on Thursday, February 19th, 2026. We are in Capitol Room 124, and my apologies for starting 10 minutes late. We had another committee in here, and it takes a little while. So members present today include Representative Gray, Representative Hall, Representative Sadler, Representative Allard, and myself, Representative Eichheide, Chair. Let the record reflect, we have a quorum to conduct business. Please remember to silence your cell phones for the meeting. I'd also like to extend a thank you to Cale Brown from House Records and Zachary Lawhorn from Juno LIO and my committee aide, Aaron Callahan, a proud veteran, for staffing the committee today. Today we have a presentation on the Alaska Organized Militia's response to Typhoon Halong. Here to present the response is Deputy Commissioner Craig Christensen, Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and Angela the Flam, Legislative Aide to the Adjutant General, Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Thank you. Please come forward to the dais, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your presentation. And a little context for the name pronunciation. We've been struggling with that a little bit. Just doing our best.
So good morning, committee. For the record, Craig Christensen, Deputy Commissioner, Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
And good morning, Angela LaFlamme, Legislative Liaison for Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
And in the room also, I have Mr. Bob Earnesty, and he's our Administrative Services Director, and also Mr. Brian Fisher, who is our Director of Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management. So today we are going to talk a little bit about the organized militia response to Typhoon Halong. Before I do that, just a few introductory slides to remind you of our department's mission is to provide military forces to accomplish missions in the state and around the world, provide homeland security defense, emergency preparedness, response, and recovery, provide services to veterans, and provide military-style education and training to youth at risk of not graduating. So our organizational chart for our department, Major General Sachs is the Adjutant General. The two dotted line organizations are the Civil Air Patrol and Alaska Aerospace Corporation. We work very closely with the Civil Air Patrol, although they are not officially within our department. And the Adjutant General is on the board of the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, although Alaska Aerospace does not receive any general funds from the state. Moving down, we have the Office of Veterans Affairs, Alaska Military Youth Academy, Division of Administrative Services, and Homeland Security Emergency Management. But today we're here to talk about the organized militia, and you see that is located within the dotted lines, and it's our Air National Guard, our Army National Guard, Alaska State Defense Force, and our Alaska Naval Militia. The Air and the Army Guard make up approximately 4,000 members. The Alaska State Defense Force are an all-volunteer organization, approximately 225 people spread across the state, many in the small villages out west. And then Alaska Naval Militia, they're all reservists, either Navy or Marine reservists. And they're a small force, about 50 members.
All right. Thank you for the record, Angela LaFlamme. Just to continue kind of laying a foundation about disaster response and how that fits in within our operations, under AS 2623, the Alaska Disaster Act, the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management works with our partners across the state to develop and maintain the State of Alaska Emergency Operations Plan. That designates DHSEM and the State Emergency Operations Center as the main central coordination agency for disaster response, or emergency response isn't always a disaster.
Sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. This is just a broad overview of the response process. Typically, an incident will occur, and the local community will be the first to respond. They will assess what is happening and whether or not they need additional assistance or they have the capacity at the local level to respond to the incident.
And just a quick interruption. I do want to recognize that Representative Nellie Jimmy is in the room, and she's been here since the start. So my apologies. And you're welcome to join us up here if you'd like to. There's a space there at the end. Because this is an area that affected Representative Jimmy's district quite severely, and she may have some questions at some point. So thank you. Continue.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Angela LaFlamme. When an event occurs and the local it exceeds the local capacity for response, the State Emergency Operations Center works with the governor's office to do an initial damage assessment, and if it rises to the level, declare a state disaster. The governor can declare a state disaster. That opens access to the disaster relief fund and utilizing state funds for emergency response. Within the Alaska Organized Militia, right next door to the State Emergency Operations Center is the Joint Operations Center. This is where the coordination for all our military activities happen in partnership with the State Emergency Operations Center. The Joint Operations Center serves as incident command for the National Guard, and they have liaisons from every organization within the Alaska Organized Militia that sit in the room to be liaisons for operations, logistics, mobilizing personnel or volunteers when requested. And they receive their those requests from the State Emergency Operations Center. The Joint Operations Center will put out a request for volunteers when they are asked for in emergency response. And based on the requirements of those requests is when our Alaska Organized Militia would respond. So,
and I'd like to add, so we're unique in Alaska and very lucky the way our department is set up. So our Adjutant General, Major General Sachs, is not only the commander of the organized militia, but he is also fills roles very similar to a commissioner. He's the head of the department. So he has the Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management under him in the department, and also the National Guard. So that's very important because the National Guard and Homeland Security Emergency Management and Disaster Response work very closely together. In my military career, when I've worked, I worked for NORTHCOM, and I went provided assistance to many disasters. And a lot of states, the Joint Operations Center and the State Emergency Operations Center aren't even in the same city. The same person doesn't control both. You know, a lot of times Homeland Security Emergency Management will be under public safety, and then you have the Guard under the Adjutant General. And I've seen a lot of disconnects in other states. Us having the Joint Operations Center and the State Emergency Operations Center next door under the control of the same person is very, very beneficial to our state. Okay, now we're going to get into what we're here for, so to actually talk about Typhoon Halong. First thing I'd like to mention is, this briefing is specific to the organized militia. So we recognize that many, many, many organizations, federal, state, local, tribal, nonprofits, non-government organizations, be afraid to start listing them because I would inevitably leave way too many people out. It was a huge response and couldn't have been done with all the teamwork that we had from all the partners. But so I'm not leaving them out, but I'm only speaking to our organized militia's response to Halong. So just recognize that many, many, many other organizations played a very, very important part. So as the storm came up the coast, it became evident that it was going to be a very devastating storm. But, you know, predicting exact paths are very difficult. So, you know, when we started out, we were looking at the entire West Coast and not really being able to, you know, predict specific, you know, specific villages. So, as Angela said, all disasters start out local. So the local governments, the local organizations all opened up their disaster plans and started opening shelters and preparing people and getting ready for the storm. As the storm passed, we realized just how devastating the storm was. And this slide, many of you have seen many pictures of homes that left their foundations and with people in them and, you know, were actually heading out to sea. When I flew in to Kipnuk a couple days after the storm, I mean, you know, it was horrifying to, as you're not even close to the town yet, village yet, and to see homes just, you know, scattered out amongst the tundra. And so this search and rescue mission was the largest search and rescue mission that has occurred in Alaska. It was a combination of the Coast Guard, the National Guard, the troopers, the VPSOs, local search and rescue. Huge undertaking to, you know, they rescued about 51 people that, you know, many of them were on the roofs of their houses as it's floating away. And, you know, you can see in the one picture on the right, a hoist, hoisting people up. 51 people in a day were saved. And, you know, and it couldn't have been done without the, you know, teamwork of all those entities, not just the National Guard.
And just a quick interruption. We've been joined by Representative David Nelson at 10:37 a.m. Thank you for joining us.
So in previous years, we've always showed this slide of the hub and spoke construct that we use. And this is a perfect example. Normally, when we show this slide, we're talking about pushing forces out, you know, to defend Alaska. And but you can, you know, reverse the arrows. And here, you know, as we evacuated people, the evac plan had us, you know, bringing people from the villages to Bethel, and then, you know, from Bethel back to Anchorage. So when we set up, when the storm had passed and it was safe for the major forces to start rolling in, we set up four task forces. The one task force was Task Force Kotzebue, then we had Task Force Nome, Task Force Bethel, and then Task Force Anchorage. So the Joint Operations Center, it was kind of the, you know, command and control. And then we had the four task forces out there. Very quickly, it was realized that the main forces were needed in Bethel. And so, you know, after a few days to a week, both the Kotzebue and the Nome task forces were, then those forces were shifted down to where they were needed in Bethel. The Anchorage task force was more command and control, logistics, you know, supplies, some shelter support and that kind of stuff. So these pictures you can see here on the right, that's a Chinook helicopter. We also use Blackhawks. The runways in the villages would not allow for a larger military fixed-wing aircraft. So we evacuated approximately,
501 evacuated from villages to Bethel using the Chinooks and Blackhawks. Sorry for the record. This is Angela. 659 evacuated onward from Bethel to Anchorage using the C-17s.
Yeah. So the picture on the left there is a C-17, and in order to get as many people out as expeditiously as possible, you can see that they are squeezed in there, sitting on the floor, and we were able to effectively transport those people to Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, where thanks to the Anchorage School District and use of their buses, we're able to bus them to the shelters. We use the Egan Center and the Alaska Airlines Center. This is not easy. This is very difficult with, boom, this thing happens, and you start moving hundreds and hundreds of people, and, you're trying to find a venue that, it doesn't have something going on, or if there is something going on, you got to mitigate that. And then, you're getting, you're sourcing cots, your blankets, people need clothing. They need to get their medicines that they didn't bring. They need, medical professionals, mental health professionals, dealing with the post office. How do we get the mail, get their mail routed? So many, issues that had to be dealt with, like, all immediately. So Brian Fisher's team worked with an amazing amount of, agencies and nonprofits and NGOs, non-government organizations, to actually make that happen. And so over the course of, I think after about 3 to 4 days, we had finished the major evacuation to Anchorage. And then, go ahead, next slide.
We had a question from Representative Allard on that previous slide.
Thank you. And just to put on the record, you said Brian Fisher's team. I know who Brian Fisher is. He's one of my constituents. But I wanted to find out, could you tell the position so the public knows what Mr. Fisher actually does?
Sure. Okay. So Brian Fisher is the director of the Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management. So he's in the room. Brian has worked for that division for 30 years, and he will be retiring within the next year. And if you asked him, he can tell you down to the second. he is the historian, and he has a wealth of knowledge of everything disaster related in this state. So we're very lucky to still have him on, and a lot of the success of this disaster response is directly because of Brian.
Mr. Fisher, can you just raise your hand so we can all see who you are? Thank you, sir. Thank you. Okay. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Deputy Commissioner. My question is about the total number of folks who were displaced by Typhoon Halong. The media reports I followed it was always saying at least this many. We know that this many, and I know that we probably have a very accurate count of how many people were evacuated to Anchorage because you put them on the planes to come there. But I'm curious about how we keep track of the total number of displaced, because it wasn't just the two villages. There were other villages where people were displaced. Mm-hmm. And do you guys keep track of that, or who actually is kind of keeping the track of exactly how many people are displaced?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, Craig Christensen for the record. We track how many people we have evacuated. We are not able to track people that have self-evacuated or maybe another organization did. So, we had a total of 659 that we evacuated from Bethel to Anchorage. And so we also can track how many people were sheltering, so which could be different than the number that we evacuated because they may have self-evacuated and then needed a shelter. However, other people may have evacuated to Anchorage and stayed with friends, so they didn't stay in a shelter. So we, there is no easy way to tell you the exact number of the total number of people that left. We can tell you how many that we've evacuated and how many people were in shelters. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, for the record, Angela LaFlamme, through the chair, Representative Gray. We did, so the state disaster declaration opened up our individual assistant and public assistant programs. So through the individual assistant programs, survivors can apply for support both through the state, initially with the state, and now through FEMA. That's a federal disaster declaration. And so I think we're over 2,000. Applications for that. That does not mean that everybody is currently displaced still, but a lot of people were impacted by the disaster. Some may have been able to go back to their homes in the days or weeks following after repairs have been able to be made. But we can try to get some more information for the committee on how many people we may still have displaced.
Thank you.
Please do. Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Chair Eichheit. I just wanted to, to follow up with Representative Gray asking that you, what was published in the news or what you guys tracked just alone from Bethel to Anchorage. So you're saying there's no account for how many other people who had to evacuate was to Bethel and then even to other neighboring villages. So what was what you're saying is what was reported in the newspaper, it's higher than what is reported that people were evacuated, correct?
Likely.
Can we ask Mr. Fisher could come up?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Out. Yeah.
There he is.
Ask and thou shall receive.
You're good. Good morning. For the record, Brian Fisher, Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, through the Chair, Representative Jimmy. That's correct. What the numbers that were reported in the media initially, and it's always hard when you're trying to count specific numbers, but you know, the largest portion of the displaced folks came to Anchorage, but there are still probably upwards of hundreds of folks displaced from their community and not residing in Anchorage, and we don't own them. We're not tracking them because they're not taking they're not using our funding necessarily or FEMA's. So there are many folks throughout the entire Yukon-Kuskokwim region that have been displaced from their communities. We all have heard about Kipnuk and Kwikalingook, the two most impacted, but just for example, we just are working on moving a family from Nightmute to Eek this week. So there are still residents of the area and survivors of this disaster that are still being displaced. You know, they've tried to make a go at it back home in their damaged homes over the winter, and some still have to move. So that number is ever changing, but it certainly was the population that was displaced and remains displaced to this day much larger than just the folks that the organized militia moved to Anchorage and that were taken care of in hotels and apartments.
Thank you.
Representative Allard.
Yeah, he probably wants to stay. We enjoy you, Mr. Fisher. So I guess my question is, because we're here about the disaster, but I also want to know, because we wanted to move some money to help, and we didn't get those that funded in an amendment yesterday. So I just wanted to find out what did the militia do and how are we going to continue to have the militia state force help us? How are we going to do that? How are we going to achieve that? And what did they do to help with Typhoon Halong? I know they did a lot. I just want you to tell the committee. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're back to, okay, Ms.
Okay.
Levine.
So through the chair, Representative Allard, Director Craig Christensen, I'll skip forward because okay. We were going to hit that. A short list of things that they did. So we start out with search and rescue, a lot of aerial assets. Evacuation, a lot more aerial assets. Debris removal. So, you know, tremendous amount of debris, you know, walking around some of those villages just, you know, anything you can imagine was just thrown about. Hasty repair to some of the lesser damaged buildings. Some of the buildings, you know, weren't able to be repaired. But if we could repair a building that a family could get back into it before winter set on. Transportation of responders. So a lot of aerial assets used to transport responders around, transport equipment, transport supplies. Home damage assessments. So a lot of them, a lot of our National Guard and, well, organized militia responders were assigned to go around house to house, building to building, and using a damage assessment tool, then would, you know, was a way for us to know what the level of damage was. They had a mission that would allow for dignified reinterment of remains and caskets, which some cemeteries were disrupted. And so those were moved to a safe place for reinterment later when in the spring or summer. Command and control, logistics, providing supplies, shelter assisting with shelter management. I think that's probably complete.
Yeah, and then thank you through the chair. This is Angela LaFlamme for the record. I just have some stats to share with you on kind of all of the what Craig just mentioned. We had 18 communities that were supported throughout the little over of a month of response by the Alaska Organized Militia. We had around 30 miles of boardwalk that were cleared, 115,295 pounds of debris that was removed, 348,885 pounds of cargo that was delivered through Army and Air Aviation assets, 165,470 pounds of warehouse supplies that were processed in the Bethel Logistics Warehouse, 491 homes that were assessed by our Alaska Organized Militia members, around 360 combined flight hours across the Alaska Organized Militia aircraft, and throughout the entire response period, we had around 221 Alaska Organized Militia members that were on state active duty in response to this. 103 from the Army National Guard, 61 from the Air National Guard, 50 from the Alaska State Defense Force, and 5 from the Alaska Naval Militia. We had an additional 194 service members from the Army and Air National Guard that were supporting in their full-time regular guard jobs, flying planes, being mechanics on those planes, etc.
Thank you for those statistics, because you went through those numbers so fast and because they're highly interesting. Can you share a copy with us, our committee?
Absolutely. I'd like to get that.
Yeah. Representative Allard?
Thank you. I think this is important to acknowledge, and I don't know if you know the numbers, but the people that are part of the Alaska State Defense Force and those part of the National Guard, these were locals too. They lost their homes. They may have lost family members, and I think that also took a toll, but they still stepped up, even though they were probably going through issues too. Do you know how many of the locals were still helping, even when they were traumatized too by all this, by the typhoon?
For the record, through the chair, Representative Allard, I don't have the exact locations, but I can follow up with the committee with that.
That would be great. Thank you. I think, Chair, they really need to be acknowledged. I mean, this is where communities come together, and I know Representative Jimmy probably knows quite a few of them that lost a lot, but they were still there to step up and put that aside just to help other community members. Thank you.
Please, yeah, if you could provide that. Representative Jimmy, did you have a...
No.
Okay.
Oh, I have something.
Representative Gray.
Thank you so much. Through the chair, I... acknowledging just an enormous amount of work and super grateful. Two quick questions. One, you said within this certain amount of time period. Mm-hmm. And so I just was wondering that some might hear that the organized militia's work is done. I'm just curious what work is still going on and how long is that mission expected to last?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Gray, Angela LaFlamme for the record. The guards... Alaska Organized Militia's response began shortly after the West Coast storms. So just as we're talking about Typhoon Halong, but there were several storms that hit leading up to that typhoon. And so the disaster really does cover several events that happened over the course of a few days. And so we did have support in Nome and Kotzebue then. That's why we had task force there. So the start of that around October 12th to demobilization on November 23rd, the Guard, the Alaskan Organized Militia, is meant to help when we need a surge of personnel on the ground to help with a lot of things in a very short period of time. The Guard especially is not meant to be a long-term solution. We are required to utilize our commercial and private industry partners to not take away from the local economy with the response or use of the military. And so I imagine that should personnel support be needed, we would be able to ask for volunteers again in the spring when work starts up again. But until that starts happening, we won't know what that request might look like.
Thank you. I don't need to ask my second question because you answered it. Thank you.
Representative Ellard.
Thank you. So I think one of the things that an earlier committee, I said it's my job as a representative to cut the budget, not to increase the budget. But I do believe that we need to allocate for this, and because we took it out, we need to put it back in. The primary reason, and I would assume you two, maybe three, Mr. Fisher back there, would agree, because in doing so, we're actually saving money. So the $1 million can go a long ways to saving money for the state, because we don't have to bring in necessarily the private industries and stuff too. I mean, it's nice to contract for all that, but do you hear what I'm saying, right? What is your thoughts? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for the record, Angela Flam, through the chair, Representative Allard. I think historically the Guard has actually been a more expensive route to go versus private contracting, but I think it depends on what, you know, if you're talking about a surge of personnel in a very short period of time, you know, it depends on the kind of personnel that you use and how much they get paid per day based on their rank, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know the figures of that to be able to say that, you know, we would save money one way or the other, but it really does take everybody together to respond to these. We couldn't do it without our private and commercial, you know, industry partners. And in this case, we couldn't do it without our organized militia members as well.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Do you want the $1 million or no?
What is?
I guess it's
at ease.
Do you, may I rephrase that question, Chair?
Back on the record, Representative Allard.
Would you appreciate additional funds for the Alaska State Defense Force?
Thank you, Representative Allard, through the Chair, Angela Flam. We do not currently have a request in the Governor's operating budget for the Alaska State Defense Force, and we support the Governor's budget.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Christensen, for being here, for giving us this information. My eye caught the distribution of I hear frequent Alaska Organized Militia, 4,000 personnel with the Army and Air Guard, 225 ASDF, and 50 Naval Militia. Is it a fair assumption or incorrect to assume that the response to the typhoon was effected proportionally to the numbers we have in membership of the different aspects, different elements of the Organized Militia? In other words, did the Guard do most, and it was proportional down the line, or did any one sector contribute beyond, punch above its weight?
So through the Chair, Representative Sadler, the ASDF provided 25% of the ASDF responded. That was definitely the highest. 10% of the Naval Militia responded, and if quick math, it's a lot less for the National Guard. Percentage-wise, so it was really the Alaska State Defense Force that percentage-wise provided the most. And I think when you look at the Alaska State Defense Force, the benefit with them is they are located throughout Alaska, you know, in a lot of villages and a lot of communities. And so they're already there. You don't have to wait for the storm to end to generate aircraft to get people out there and stuff. By and large, the National Guard members are on the road system. I mean, yes, there are some out, but percentage-wise, the Alaska State Defense Force is a organization that can easily support Western Alaska.
Follow-up?
Thank you. I'll sharpen my question. I believe you said 25% of the ASDF responded. Do you mean ASDF provided 25% of the typhoon response?
Through the Chair, correction. So the Alaska State Defense Force has approximately 225 people, and I think 53 or something responded. So 25% of the Alaska State Defense Force members were placed on state active duty.
And final follow-up.
Thank you. And so I'll refocus my question. Of the universe of response that took place, how much of it was performed by the Guard, militia, and ASDF? Can you kind of parcel out that response?
For the record, Angela LaFlamme, through the chair, Representative Sadler, on state active duty, we had 221 total members, and in their full-time guard jobs in Title 36, we had 194 members who also responded.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Of Title 32, sorry. I'm trying to get
a sense of how much of the response was provided by the National Guard, how much by the Naval Militia, how much by ASDF.
Yes, sir. Angela LaFlamme, for the record, through the chair, Representative Sadler. On state active duty, we had 103 members of the Alaska Army National Guard.
Okay.
We had 61 members of the Alaska Air National Guard. We had 50 members of the Alaska State Defense Force. And we had 5 members from the Alaska Naval Militia. And then we had an additional 194 between the Air and the Army National Guard who also responded in their regular jobs.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for that clarification.
Yeah, thank you. And I believe those are some of the figures you'll be providing later. So that will be helpful. Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Chair Eichscheid. So my staff and I have been working closely with this department since day one of the storm. It seems it would be helpful for a quick disaster funding primer, like one upfront, two, the reimbursability, and three, like the cost share percentage. If you could reshare that again.
Do you want to do that or do you want me to?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. For the record, Angela LaFlamme, through the chair, Representative Jimmy. So in the initial response, once a state disaster is declared, we are using disaster relief funds through the state that are appropriated by the legislature. When a federal disaster declaration is declared, the established amount for that cost share is 75-25. Of certain costs. That also activates the federal public assistance programs, which I know public assistance we usually use for individuals in health terms, but under disaster, that means public infrastructure, roads, airports, etc. And they also have an individual assistance program that can provide up to $42,500 this year. The amounts can change for property that was damaged to replace or repair a property, $42,500 to replace personal property that was damaged or destroyed. And they also have a temporary housing assistance program, which is how we are helping folks who've been displaced from their homes. So the state carries a lot of that cost up front, and then we're reimbursed by the federal government as we reimburse for our portions of the match for the individual assistance programs. So it is a lengthy process for funding and can take years and years and years. We still have many disasters all the way back to the 2018 earthquake that are still open and being reimbursed on for disaster expenses. So does that help answer your question? Did I hit all the points?
I mean, I understood. I just wanted to have to reshare
Thank you.
That.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just a clarification for the record, you mentioned the 75-25 on a federal declaration. Mm-hmm. Can you explain who's paying the 75?
Sorry. For the record, Angela LaFlamme, Chair Eichscheid, 75% is the federal cost share and 25% is the state cost share.
Thank you.
So for the record, Craig Christensen, we just had one more slide that will finish our formal presentation and we can continue with questions. And this is a very good news story. The National Guard evacuated lots and lots of pets. And there was some nonprofits and some shelters that were in Bethel that were doing the heavy work of reuniting them with the families. But in the center there, I think it's the first time we've ever evacuated a turtle. And and thankfully, the turtle did make it back to the owners. On the right is myself. This was a couple days after the storm, and I was in Kipnuk, and someone came up to us and said, said, this is Star, and I have, and showed me a picture of the little girl that owns Star, and said, can you, if you can get the Star to Bethel, then we'll, get Star back to her home. So, of course we did, Star got to fly to a couple villages and then go back to Bethel. And so I handed over Star to the shelter. And then doing some sleuthing through Facebook, I was able to find the owner and contact the owner and make sure that Star did get back home. So, that so there were some very good stories that did come out of this this response. So that now ends our formal presentation. We can continue with the questions.
Myself in the queue. I've been waiting. It was about this slide. I'm very interested in the pet issue. I know with other disasters in the lower 48, there have been situations where people have left their homes very quickly, and they've left their pets behind, and then it's hard to get back. And I know I knock a lot of doors and talk to a lot of constituents, and I'm always amazed how many of them have the little tag on their door that says this home has X number of cats or X number of dogs. I have the same on my door because our pets are so precious. These are nice photographs. Did you run into any situations where people were not able to retrieve their pets or where, is there... I'm very interested in this issue. So what's the flip side to this?
Thank you. For the record, Angela Flam, Chair Eichscheid. So the pet recovery response was largely led by the Department of Environmental Conservation. That's where the state veterinarian resides. And so I think I probably wouldn't do them justice for the amount of coordination and response that this really took, and I would ask that we could follow up with them to get you an answer on the pet recovery specifically.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that, and I'm curious, did you have veterinarians or vet techs volunteering to go out to these affected areas? I'll nuance that. I'm talking about Alaskan professionals, but also out-of-state veterinarians. Did you have an effort related to that?
Chair Eichscheid, I am not sure all the specifics on that particular response with DEC. I'd be happy to go offline with you and get a list of questions for you that we can have them help answer on that recovery.
Yes, yeah, please, let's do that.
Absolutely.
Representative Jimmy first.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Chair Eichscheid. So my question is, if the federal disaster wasn't declared, how much would the state be responsible to pay for?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, this is Craig Christensen, the state would have been responsible for all of it.
Yeah. Follow up?
Follow up.
So what would your ballpark be running right now for the cost right now for the storm?
Did you have that?
I just have the PA number, but I don't have the whole
number.
That's
all we have right now.
Yeah. So through the chair, Representative Jimmy, right now, as far as public assistance, which, like we said, public assistance is money that would be there for infrastructure, not for individuals, FEMA is estimating around $125 million. I am not able to estimate the total cost right now, and I have talked to Brian and his folks, and they don't have a good estimate yet either, but let's say it's a lot of money.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the Chair, Deputy Commissioner. You know, certainly the military does a great job trying to learn from their experience and do after-action reports and figure out what's going on. And I don't want to imply that the response is completed, but certainly the critical first phases are done. So even at this state of the process, do you have any perspective on what strengths or weaknesses that your response capabilities have as a result of this, you know, rather huge, challenging mission? Any thoughts on where you're doing a great job and where you might need to plus up later?
Yeah, thank you for the record, Angela LaFlamme, through the chair, Rep Sadler. We've done this a few times. So I think, you know, over the years, as we have run into issues, we've been able to address them. We've been able to streamline processes and make sure that when we're bringing people on to state active duty, that it's as quick as it can be. Everyone is told what to expect before they go out. When we have personnel that respond under state active duty or state active service, they're volunteers. And so it can be different people every time. And so there are some mobilization. It's not like you can just walk out the door. There's a little bit of a process that has to happen for mobilization. But other than that, I think over the years, we've been able to really streamline those processes and efficiencies, and it helps that, again, like Deputy Commissioner said at the beginning, to have everybody right next door to each other, the Joint Operations Center and the State Emergency Operations Center. It's nice to have that communication be works well.
So follow up. So I think what I hear you saying is that you got it pretty much dialed. You've done this before. You know what you need to do, and there's might be some little hiccups, but have you seen any systemic or not systemic, that sounds accusatory. Any general areas where you can do better or things where you are not doing as well as you thought you had the capability? Just on a self-appraisal and criticism or self-congratulation, giving that chance.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this is Craig Christensen. As Angela said, there internally we have some processes that bring people on to state active duty that we need to streamline. So, you know, in the sense that we want to get people out the door so fast that sometimes we'll get them out the door and then we'll do the paperwork later. But we have ways looking at some electronic and digital ways that possibly we can streamline that so we're not playing catch up. You know, our whole goal is to get the people out the door and the responders out, and you know, we'll do the paperwork and the that stuff later. But we have some ideas that we will be fixing internally that, you know, doesn't affect the response. It just affects us internally and the amount of work we're doing behind the scenes.
And if I could add one more thing, Angela LaFlamme, for the record, through the chair, part of the payroll coming back to the departments, we volunteered because we do have a unique situation where we're paying people who come on in a temporary fashion and get paid through our state payroll system. And so having folks in our department who understand that process and understand how that fits in with the payroll process is going to be immensely helpful for us.
Okay. So it sounds like just to wrap so the paperwork aspect, I appreciate the Alaska spirit of get it done, do the paperwork later. But so it sounds like you have the equipment you need, the personnel you need, the procedures you need to keep doing it. So thank you.
Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Chair Eichscheid. I don't know who can answer this, but can you compare this event in the scale to other disasters that happened in Alaska, like any other disaster?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, this is Craig Christensen. So, you know, anyone that's heard Brian talk about this disaster, Brian Fisher, he's worked here.
Could we get Commissioner Fisher to answer that?
Sure.
Please do.
Thank you, Chair Eichscheid.
Thanks. For the record, Brian Fisher, Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, through the Chair, Representative Jimmy. Certainly in my career, I've been there in the agency for 31 years now. This is the largest disaster in terms of the number of homes that have been destroyed, the extensive impact to a couple of the communities, Kipnuk and Quinglinguk, like I mentioned earlier. So speaking with some folks, yesterday, there may have been more homes in the 1964 earthquake in South Central Alaska that suffered extensive damage like this. But outside of the 64 quake, this is probably the largest disaster that we've dealt with since statehood. The largest domestic evacuation of folks from any region of the state. We're pretty confident that this is the largest. Those pictures you saw earlier of the aircraft and the C-17, that's unprecedented for us to do that. The amount of time folks will be displaced from the community, which is, I don't think everybody's going to be able to get home this summer. The repair and rebuilding effort is going to be that large. So that's unprecedented as well. There's the amount of time that people are going to be displaced. So, I mean, without a doubt, this is the largest kind of disaster that we're dealing with. And, the estimates that we have from FEMA, when we're talking about the cost, those are early estimates. We are very, very early in this. So I think this is going to be an incredibly expensive and a very long time to get the communities rebuilt and get folks home. So, yeah, probably the biggest since the 64 quake by far.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions before we wrap up? Representative Sadler.
Sure. I have a question that does not pertain to the organized militia's response to the typhoon, but rather to the entire department. Would it be appropriate or welcome to ask a different question?
Yes, point? Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. And through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Christensen, we don't often have the chance to have you in front of us, and I spoke with Angela a little bit during the interim. There was an executive order from the federal command authority for the Guard in every state to prepare a quick response force or a response force. And I understand Alaska has taken some steps toward that. There have been some legal developments that have impinged on that. I guess I'd like to have on the record just some information about where the effort stands to train a response force from the Alaska National Guard for possible deployment for civil control.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, Craig Christensen. So I can speak briefly on that. Well, we did not prepare for that for this. So a little confusion. So it's the National Guard Response Force. People also call it a Quick Reaction Force, which is different. It's not something that our state has been tasked with. So the National Guard Response Force is a capability that all National Guards have had for as long as they've existed. I mean, all the way back to the Whiskey Rebellion when George Washington asked the militia. What the National Guard started to do about after Katrina and after 911 was to standardize training across the country, standardize the way people, the way the different units interact and what their training is and what they do. So as that moved forward, it's had different names, different versions, Homeland Response Force, different titles, different ways to use. But what they recently did was the National Guard Bureau put out standardization of missions that the Guard has always done. So, I understand that some people seemed like it was a new thing and there was a response to something happening now. But the missions have always been a Guard mission, and it has just a new name and standardization across the country. As far as the Alaska National Guard, probably about 100 members are assigned to it. The training needs to be completed by the end of March. We've sent people to the train the trainer course, and they train at their monthly drills. And it's pretty much the basics that I can easily share that I have in my brain right now about it.
And a brief follow-up?
Thank
you. And through the chair, Deputy Commissioner, do you believe the National Guard from Alaska is being readied for are there plans or intentions to deploy Guard outside the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there are currently no planning efforts to send the National Guard Response Force out. Now, there is the possibility that we would send a few people to the mission in Washington, D.C., possibly. Nothing in writing, possibly. That's different than the National Guard Response Force. That's just, you know, a request from the president for National Guard members to D.C., much like we do. And we've done that just about every state sends people to the inauguration. We've sent last few inaugurations. We've sent National Guard members to D.C. It's not something new. And, you know, did you have something to add? Okay.
And just follow up just to say, I appreciate very much hearing that there are currently no plans. I hope there are not plans. I've had some of my constituents expressing concerns and having questions. I very much appreciate you answering some of those questions here today. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Good question. Representative Gray.
Thank you. And thank you so much for that clarification, Deputy Commissioner Christensen. The confusion came because of Major General Ronald Burkett's memo.
Yes.
So I just want to be clear.
Yeah.
But I wanted to follow up on a different line of questioning. Just, I know that the National Guard has 5 individuals assisting Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Anchorage, but then I understood that was increased to 6 members. And so I was just curious about the need to increase the number to 6, if you had any information about why we needed 6 National Guard.
Thank you. For the record, Angela LaFlamme, through the chair, Representative Gray. The initial ask was for 6 members. We could not provide 6 members at the beginning, so we provided 5. And as soon as a 6th member was available to meet that ask, we were able to put 6 on.
Thank you.
Follow up.
And just a comment, I will quote Senator Lisa Murkowski stating that with the $88 billion budget for ICE, that they probably don't need help, that they should be able to afford all of the employees that they need. But that's a comment. You don't need to respond. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Chair Eichscheid. It's just more of a closing comment. I just wanted to thank you all for your assistance, Deputy Commissioner Craig. Christensen and Legislative Liaison Angela LaFlamme, and everybody who helped with the storm, the militia who volunteered to help each other and their people translate, and for our people to translate in Town Hall, and special shout out to Commissioner Fisher. Thank you. And we'll do the countdown with you for your well deserved retirement. So, oh yeah, no. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also want to thank the Deputy Commissioner and Angela being here. And I really appreciate you bringing the information about the Guard, the entire organized militia's response to Typhoon Halong. It's easy to sit in Juneau and not really realize what's going on in the real world out in Alaska, no offense to Juneau, and to know that our capability to respond to even the most challenging and unpredictable but destructive natural disasters is strong in Alaska. People don't realize all the work and training goes on day in, day out, and the unexciting, boring days for possible deployment when when the balloon goes up. So I want to thank you for giving this committee and the public the expression of just how strong our capabilities are. We debated funding and so forth, but it's good to know where the money's going for, what's being done, and how it's benefiting our constituents. Thank you, sir.
And seeing no further questions, my comment, just thank you to all the heroes in Alaska that have helped with this effort and continue to help with this effort. Makes us all proud to be Alaskans, to serve with other great Alaskans. So thank you. Deputy Commissioner Christensen, Ledge Liaison, LaFlamme, thank you for being here and presenting. Also, Mr. Brian Fisher and Bob Ernesty for being in the room, and thank you for your service. That concludes our agenda for the day. For a brief preview of the next week, at our next meeting, which is this next Tuesday, February 24th, we will hear House Bill 256, sponsored by Representative Will Stapp. There will be invited testimony. And then on the following Thursday, February 26th, we will hear House Bill 299, also sponsored by Representative Will Stapp, and also with invited testimony. This meeting of the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs is now adjourned at 11:23 a.m.